peace to the people. This is Mike Jr. and you're listening to On the Move podcast, where we illuminate the struggles of the people, inform the uninformed, and give you nothing but the truth. On the Move is here to disrupt the system and spark a global revolutionary change. Change is going to come, like Sam Cooke said. But like Gandhi said, you have to be the change you want to see in the world. And even though Gandhi wasn't perfect, he said something that was true. And when the power of truth is present, you better respect it. Today, I have a couple of very special guests, two of the most special people in the world to me. Of course, my parents, mom and dad, and Debbie and Mike Sr. to you. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey. Thanks.
How are you feeling?
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. This is the first time we've seen both of you on the show at the same time, right? And this is for a very important reason. For the people who are unaware, my uncle, Chuck, has been battling cancer for a few years. And on September the 20th at 3:10 a.m., my uncle Chuck, a.k.a. Chuck Africa, passed away at the age of 61. There's not two better people to talk about Chuck than you two, I think, from the standpoint that you guys have been with him for a long time. Mom, he's your little brother. Dad, you spent a lot of years with him in prison, right? And known him since he was a teenager, right?
Before a teenager.
Before he was a teenager?
Yeah, I know Chuck since he was 7 or 8.
I guess I just want to hear your thoughts, Mom. Like, how are you feeling right now?
Well, not too bad right now, but I just have my moments because he was just spending that last year and a half with him and watching him go through what he went through. And I've never, ever seen or met anybody that was just so strong-willed and so determined to just be a fighter. And he fought every step of the way since I've been with him, since he came home last February, a year and a half ago. And when I tell you, he fought to the end. Even the nurses are talking about how amazing he was, and they just thought that he was gonna, you know, cross over sooner than he did. And they said, oh my God, he's just so amazing. He's just so strong. He's just so strong-willed. And that really, it's sad in a lot of ways, because he just coming into the organization at 13 or 14 years old and then going to prison at 18 years old and spending 42 years in prison, coming home to this disease that we're very suspect of, and as far as him and a couple of the other men having that disease from the same prison. But coming home and having to fight that after he has fought, you know, all his life to protect what he felt was a movement, what he felt was something to fight for.
He was very unselfish. Yeah, he was a fighter, right? That's what I always heard about Chuck, Uncle Chuck. He never backed down from any physical challenge. I remember Grandma talking about him. So she was after me for something. She had the belt and she was coming after me, and I was running from her, right? And I was running around the table to get away from her. And I did it so much to get away from her that it became funny to her, right? She started laughing. And I was happy she started laughing, because that meant that she wasn't as angry as she was before. So she wasn't coming for me anymore. And she said it reminded her of Chuck. He used to do that same kind of thing. But as far as like him in his early life, you said you knew him since he was like 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. What was your memories of him like from back then?
Well, I was dating his older sister. Right. And Chuck was like the watcher of the house, because their dad wasn't in the house. So your grandmom put him in charge. Like, you know, he's the oldest.
He was 7-8 years old, and he was in charge.
He was in charge of watching over his sister. So,
so over the house. Did he take his job serious?
Very seriously. And he used to put the couch right in front of the door. So when Debbie and I would come in the house, he would clock the time. Well, this is later, though. This is a couple of years later, you know, because when I met your mom, she was 14. This is more like when your mom was 16 or 17. He was doing this. You know, but he would sleep right
if at the couch. If he was 16, what that make? If you were 16, what did that make him? 14?
Oh, no. He was
11 or 12.
Yeah.
11 or 12, yeah. Taking his job serious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he pushed the couch up to the door.
Yeah.
For why did he push the couch up to the door?
Because he wanted to wake up. If it was later, then he went to sleep. You know, he wanted to wake up and know and mark the time.
So you couldn't get past him. When you opened the door, in order to come in, you had to get past him.
Right. And he made sure he let his mom know that, you know, that he came in too late. And that Mike brought her home too late. And, you know, he's getting on everybody about it, you know.
He was 11 years old, and my mother made this announcement to our detriment. We're three older sisters. He's the second youngest of us. And she made this announcement at the table saying, your father's not here, so Chucky is the oldest boy, and now he is in charge of the house. Why did she do that? He did exactly what Mike said. He clocked us. When we would go out, he would sit there with a watch on his wrist and the couch at the door so that when we came in, he would know it. And he looked at the watch. Debbie, it's 2:00 in the morning. What are you doing coming in this late? I said, shut up, boy. You don't tell me what to do. He said, Mom made me the head of the house, and I'm telling you, you're too late. Mom, Debbie came in the house at 2:00 in the morning. And he would do this. Mm-hmm. We couldn't have no boyfriends. Like, he did that.
He took his job serious.
Yes, he did that to all of us. But at the time, you know, me and Mike was, you know, more like, we were more steady than Sharon. I think she was kind of older, so she didn't, you know, she didn't care. She, you know.
He clock her too?
And not as much. But he did still tell if it was anything. He off the
you
record.
You didn't pass Chuck.
No, he took his job very seriously.
It's like, you know, imagining what he looked like and imagining him do that as a as a child, right? It's really interesting how he carried those traits on, the protectiveness,
yep,
and the unselfishness. He carried that those elements like throughout his life, and he put them into some really positive things. And the first time I met Chuck was at Greaterford Prison. He had gotten into a fight. Surprise, surprise, right? He got into a fight. Something happened where somebody said something, did something, and he was helping somebody else in whatever, and they got into a fight. And Grandma was like, Chuck, are you hurt? He was like, Mom. She was frantic because she was trying to understand if he was hurt or not. He was just going off. And she was like, Chuck, are you hurt? Are you hurt? And he was like, no, Mom, I'm pissed. I'm pissed. No, I'm not hurt, but I want to get these motherfuckers. He was just so angry because what they did, the guards did, was such an injustice. And he wasn't even thinking about himself. Mm-hmm. He was just so mad about what happened. And this brother that got hurt because of the guards, and he just wanted to get him. So he said, Mom, I need to get out of here. So she said, all right, this is a morning phone call. So we went to the prison. I don't know what it was that he was at Greaterford, because he didn't stay there long. Maybe he was getting transferred or something, and that may have been a stopping point or a stepping stone or whatever, because he didn't stay there long. Shortly after that, he went to this other place. But when we got there, I think we might have spent a few hours with him, right? And this is my first time ever meeting him that I remember. And like the whole time, he wasn't thinking about really the visit, right? He was thinking about how he was going to deal with the situation once he got back in the jail, you know, because he could not, you know how Chuck was. He, once he got something in his mind,
Oh, yeah.
He wanted to do something. Mm-hmm. He was committed to it, and you couldn't change his mind.
Oh, yeah.
Until he did it, mm-hmm. to see it through, changing his mind was nearly impossible. You experienced that type of stuff with Chuck, right, Dad? Like,
oh, sure.
He was determined to do certain things.
Yeah, but he didn't usually react in a way where, I mean, we could have been in a major confrontation,
mm-hmm.
you know, fights with people or whatever. And, you know, we could have broken bones, concussions and stuff, and Chuck would be laughing.
Laughing about what?
You know, people mess with you, or people messed with us before they really got a chance to know who we were and what we were about, really. Mm-hmm. You know, just by reputation, you know, you gave the city a lot of trouble. So once we got in the prison system, you know, our reputations kind of preceded us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they'd harass us just as a point, you know, of solidarity, I guess, with, you know, the officials or something. And so sometimes we get into confrontations over, you know, stuff that was really nonsense,
mm-hmm.
you know, really petty.
So I'm trying to understand what he would have been laughing about, though.
That he had a fight, that he struck back. No matter how much they got us, you got a chance to get something off your chest. And Chuck had a very broad chest.
He was tough, too. He could take a punch.
You know, when they brought in more and more, and we were overwhelmed, seemingly. Okay, this is something out of Spartacus, you know. They just kept on coming with more troops. And finally, you know, you're overwhelmed and, you know, they think you're beaten. And they think you're a coward. And, yeah, we got you. And Chuck, didn't do nothing here. You know, you didn't. That was his attitude. You know, you didn't defeat us. You didn't break our spirit. You didn't, you know, that's just Chuck, man.
Gave him that. Where did that come from in him, Mom? Was he a fighter like that when he was a kid?
Fighter? Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was bad. He was the reason, him and Dennis was the reason, my younger brother was the reason we got to move in the beginning.
Do y'all have cousins that y'all hung out with, played with as kids?
Sometime, yeah.
Were they like that too?
No.
No?
Frank, no, absolutely not. Frank and, but the other cousins were my Uncle Fonnie's boys, Fonnie and Michael. Yeah, they were tough too. Fonnie was rough and tough.
So the trait that Chuck had may have been a Leapheart trait?
Could have been.
I don't know. Your grandma.
My grandmother was tough. My mother.
Shoot, man. Huh? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She was.
My mother,
was
tough. Yeah.
And Louise.
Mm-hmm.
They were tough, man. Straight shooters, they, you know, they didn't mince.
Mm-mm. Nah, that wasn't mincing. Mm-mm, nah.
Coot, too. She was just, she just did us different, but she's very stubborn, very, very strong-willed. She didn't want to do something.
Couldn't make her.
Nope, couldn't make her. Never did.
You know, the thing that Chuck was really popular for in the movement was this thing where he said, when the news media was asking him, what's your strategy? What's your strategy? And he, mm-hmm. strategy of John Africa. And they kept asking, well, what is that? And he said, what's right? What is that? The strategy of John Africa. He just kept, and the news guy said, you're not telling me anything. He said, hey, I wouldn't tell my strategy mm-hmm. to you.
Yeah.
Chuck was like, how old was he when he was 16, 17?
Maybe when that happened?
About that.
Looking at some of the footage of him on some of those old videotapes of Move and Confrontation, he was very courageous. And you could see that he was,
mm-hmm.
it was hard. It's hard to believe that he was that young. in age with that kind of confidence and that mm-hmm. kind of like clear visioned.
Yeah. I remember when they, the first demonstration I ever went to was because of Chuck.
Right.
You know, because before then I wasn't particularly interested in any movement, you know, but I knew Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
And when they said he had been thrown in jail for something, I'm like, Chucky's like 12, man. He's 13 years old. How, you know, what they put him in jail for? And it was some kind of thing about he said something to a judge when the judge said something to him about truancy, because that's why he was in mm-hmm. court. And Chuck said something to him about what real education was and that he wanted to get a real education, and that's what he was receiving outside of the schoolroom. Mm-hmm. And the judge gave him 10 days. While Chuck was in jail, the governor of Pennsylvania was visiting the jails in Philadelphia.
Governor Shapp?
Yeah. And Chuck was on the front page of Daily News.
For what?
He was saying something to Shapp. And he was telling Shapp, he was giving Shapp information that he had sort of gave in court about real education. And that's why they were there and they were being mistreated in there. And, you know, him and other little boys, how they were being treated and something needed to be done about it. And, you know, this is why they demonstrated against the city and, you know, the like. So, and they took a picture of it because, you know, he had his entourage there to take publicity shots.
Shapp had his entourage?
Yeah, you know, so.
Is that the picture of Chuck grabbing his arm?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But he was on the front page of the Daily News. And he was 13. You know, he saw it as an opportunity. He took the opportunity to give him information about why they were there, man. That's Chuck. It's quintessential Chuck. You know, it didn't, you know, he didn't see fear. He wasn't fearful of moments and of people, you know, no matter who they were.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's so brave and just so, like you said, unselfish. Like he still never thinks about himself. I don't care. I mean, even on his, you know, couch that he was on that he loved, that I needed to get rid of on his deathbed. He was like, don't worry about me, Debbie. Don't worry about me. Don't worry about me. Just, you know, hitting his chest. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, he didn't have a life. But that's what makes me so angry about the situation with Chuck, because he fought for what he felt like he believed in. He believed in John Africa. He believed in MOVE. He believed in MOVE people. He loved MOVE people. You know, since, I mean, they 13 years old, they pretty much, I mean, he was raised there. They're like his real family. All that he went through, fought for, you know, and MOVE for what he felt like was revolution and a cause. You know, all that he protected his sisters, his MOVE sisters, protected John Africa's wife, you know, taking beatings with sticks. Broomsticks, bucket handles, knives, you name it, they came with it. Mop ringers, this is what happened to them. Chuck, Mike, and the other men on December 3rd, 1982, I believe it was, 1981. And this is what, I mean, these are the beatings that he took among the other men too, but just speaking about him. And this is the kind of stuff he went through to protect his family, to feel like he was protecting his family, his sisters. And, you know, in the end, they were not there for him. They were not there for him because he disagreed with a lot of decisions that was going on at home. You know, they just wanted to kick him out the organization and tell him he wasn't a MOVE member no more. And it's that, you know, he was hurt, but he kept going. He said, you know, I'm not giving into it. But, and this is what I really, really resent about that and about MOVE doing that to him, because not only did they kick him out of the organization the way they did it, but he did it when he had stage 4 cancer. They had other supporters, not all of them, but some of them, that were influenced by them to snipe at Chuck through social media. They don't even know nothing about Chuck. They never walked in his shoes. They never went to jail. They never stepped foot in a jail cell. And to have them or whomever did it sniping at him, and I mean sniping at him through social media when they didn't know a goddamn thing about him, I mean, that really set me off. And I already had a lot of feelings. I just didn't feel the same way I did used to anyway. But that really, really threw me over the edge with them because it was so wrong. It was so hateful. It was so hurtful. And like I said, the people that was doing it, it was just only one or two, maybe one, that said these things about Chuck on social media. How dare you? And how dare you move? How dare you, Alberta? How dare you, Sue, to encourage somebody to do that, knowing what Chuck had been through, knowing what he went through to protect your ass, John Africa's wife. And I'm telling you right now, look, that shit was so fucked up. 42 years and they turned their back on him with stage 4 cancer and still trying to call the house, calling him, talk. You know what? Leave him alone. But that's why I resent the hell out of him. One of the only one of the reasons, because I had to watch him die. I had to watch him for a year and a half die on a couch with no life.
When you think about what he went through and how long the suffering lasted in the later years, the cancer part, that's really, really, that's really, really messed up. And throughout it all, he was still very unselfish. Even when the people had turned on him, he was still trying to make a way to get people out of prison.
Everybody.
Mm-hmm. Everybody.
Yep. Yeah. Everybody out.
He was hurt that people turned on him, but he was still adamant about making sure that the lawyer visited them
mm-hmm.
and brought them into the case so that they could come home. And when I asked him, I said, well, you know, they're not supporting you. How do you feel? How do you want to proceed? He said, that don't matter. Everybody need to come home. He said, they my sisters. And he said, start with them. He wasn't concerned about those incidents as much as he was making sure that everybody got home. And I think the thing that he expressed to me that hurt him, he said, they didn't even thank him. It is to me, as one of the main people that was on the streets involved in putting pieces in place for the parole to happen, it's clear to me that without Chuck pushing for people to come home, they would not have come home. And they were not involved in the case, and the people who they look up to were not either. But Chuck, he was hurt. He was definitely hurt by the fact, he said that. He said they didn't even thank him. Yeah.
And that wasn't the only time either that he put himself out there. And
what do you mean?
I mean that, you know, Chuck was trying to take the whole case onto himself. Like, let everybody else go.
Like, yeah, keep me in here forever. I'll confess to it so that everybody else can go home.
So yep. That everybody else can go home.
And he did it. He wrote a letter to the DA. And he didn't kill nobody. He just took it on himself, like you said, unselfishly, and said, you know, he felt like as a man, he had to do this. So he wrote a letter to the district attorney. I think it was Len Abraham at the time, and said it. He said, I killed the officer. I did it. Let my other sisters and brothers go. Let them go. They wouldn't do it. But the point is that this is the kind of loyalty
unselfish. Yeah.
Man that he was, and that he, and I want to make this point very clear, because it's just indicative of the structure on how everything was gritted. The influence that they have on people. On
they
people.
Who are you talking about there?
I'm talking about MOVE people right now. In particular, the people who are in what they call leadership now, Alberta and Sue. The kind of influence that they would have on people would make people, even some supporters that were dedicated to them, Bert and Sue or whatever, and make them actually hate you, and they don't know nothing about you. So they would tell you these lies the same way they did with Chuck. They would twist things around like they did with Chuck because he disagreed with issues and things that they were doing at home. He said, no, I don't agree with it. You shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be doing this. And it would get down to a fight, verbal fight on the phone. And then they would say, well, like getting a lawyer. Okay, well, we don't believe in lawyers. No, we're not going to do that. And you're questioning John Africa if you'd want to go that route and this, that, and the other. And then start telling people, well, Chuck don't believe in John Africa. Or he said something about John Africa. And the point is that you can have whatever, you can feel what you want to feel. But the way that they would twist things around and just make people hate you is what they would do. So people that didn't even know, and I really need to make this point because nobody has the right to condemn somebody, especially if they have never walked in their shoes, if they have never felt what Chuck felt. I mean, these people or person that was talking that trash about Chuck don't know a goddamn thing about him. And it's just, I can't even think of the words.
I can feel your hurt and your anger right now. Is it all coming out because you Chuck just passed? Is it what is it?
Well, it's just something I've been feeling for a long time since this happened with Chuck since he'd been, well, I was home, but just since it happened, and it's just watching him go through this, it's just brought it all back. You know, just brought all of it back. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember those times when people were saying things about Chuck, all at the orchestration of Alberta and Sue. And I remember they were trying to get me to not support him. And there was times where we went back and forth about this stuff because Chuck was so dedicated to his idea about what things should be like and his own way of doing things, which clashed with people a lot. But yeah, they left him for dead. And that was something that I certainly couldn't accept. And I obviously you guys couldn't accept it either. And he had a core group of people that also couldn't accept it. It's immoral. When Chuck came home, he told me, he said, Mike, he said, there's a few people that I would give my life for now. Used to be a lot. He said, but, you know, I would give, he said, if you needed a kidney, Mike, they could drop me on a table right now. I'd give it to you. If you needed a lung, don't matter, whatever it is you need. You know, I think that dedication that he has to his family, to see people treat him that way. Yeah, it was really, really, really disturbing. And then to watch people come back later and try to pretend that they were cool with him was pretty disturbing.
Yeah. But we had a lot of laughs too.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
I definitely want to focus on the really good things about Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have plenty of time to go more into some of those other issues. It can be hard to really get articulate that information clearly when the emotions are running so high. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But you had plenty of laughs with Chuck.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me one.
Well, talk about fighting and him being a fighter and a warrior to the end. He was also like that with me too. So anything,
Debbie, God, Debbie, you don't know what you're talking about, Debbie.
it was a fight to the finish with him to do, oh my goodness gracious, it was just a fight to the finish to do anything. I wanted to get him off of this couch that he had been in for over a year. It was sinking in. It was, oh my God, it was just, but he said it was comfortable. He said it was comfortable. Debbie, I don't want to get, I said, well, don't you want to get in this comfortable bed? No, I don't want to. I said, okay. I left him alone. And, you know, even the nurses said, no, don't worry about it. She said, that what makes him comfortable. Leave him alone. Okay. But it didn't matter what it was. Every step of the way, there was a fight. There was something. But I just learned to leave him alone because I didn't want him feeling that aggravation like that. So,
you know what? One thing I noticed about Chuck was he didn't like change. But then when the change happened,
oh,
he usually was happy with it.
And that's what happened every time. Once he got in that bed, I had to get Mike to finally ask him, tell him, you know, talk to him about the bed. And he just like, okay, all right. When he got in that bed, he was like, oh, yeah, oh, this is comfortable. It cranked up. This, oh, yeah. I said, well, Chuck, how's that bed feel? Is it comfortable? He's like, oh, no, no. Yeah, you can leave it up. You can leave it up. It's comfortable. Mm. So, yep. But as soon as he got, he said, oh, okay. Yeah, this will work. Oh, yeah, this feels good.
What was it? What was a day for you like with Chuck, Dad, when you go over this house? What was a day like for y'all?
Talking about whatever, man. That's you know, me and Chuck used to go at it about almost anything and everything. You know, music, sports, boxing.
Hey, Mike. Nah, man. The best music was between 1962 and 1962 and a half.
We could have that conversation daily.
Daily for years.
For years.
Yeah, I remember
y'all. Decades.
For decades, yeah.
Yeah. Listen, I could, you know, do some things pretty well. You know, and me and Chuck used to be sparring partners. We, you know, both used to box a lot and run. You know, we used to run the East and West River Drive and all.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, they call it Kelly Drive now.
Yeah, Kelly Drive.
And Martin Luther King.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we used to run that whole thing around and, you know, come back and we box, you know, for a long time. And Chuck was superb, man. He was a superb athlete, you know, and he could box really, really good.
Mm.
You know, he could fight, you know, but he could box also. And anyway, I'm saying this to say that, you know, I used to run. I used to run, you know, hard. I could run. Just a lot of run. When I was in prison, you know, I was still running and all. And they put me in a hole for 2 years for not cutting my hair or something. And
You might have to explain that they put you in a hole.
The administration, the prison administration,
uh-huh,
put me in a hole for 2 years.
And the hole is?
The hole is segregation, away from the population.
Mm-hmm.
And a section, it's a special block. It's an isolated block where you can't come out your cell. You can't do anything except.
How big is the cell?
The cell is, what, 8 by something? I don't know. It's okay. Small. It's really, okay. Really small.
So you're segregated in lockdown for most of the day.
Yeah. And at that time, I was up Huntington Prison, and it was written in the book that you didn't get yard every day, but when you did get it, you got it for 7 minutes.
So, okay. So they're going to let you out your cell every day for 7 minutes per day.
No, to the yard.
You're going to go out to the yard for right. 7 minutes.
For 7 minutes.
Okay. And how old were you at the time?
How old was I?
Yeah.
24.
Okay. So continue.
So I exercised as hard as I could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes they give us more time out in the yard and they wouldn't do it every day. But when you did get the yard, you stay out for maybe 20 minutes.
Mm.
So I hit the ground running, man. I was trying to stay in shape. I was doing thousands of push-ups a day and running in place and pulling up and all this kind of stuff. At the end of the 2 years of doing this, nearly every day. You know, I thought I was still in shape, you know, but I was shocked when I finally got to the track. The
once they let you out of
rest, once they out let of me
segregation,
out of the hole, right.
You went back into population and right. You could actually go outside and be out there for
a couple hours. Right. So before I went in a couple of hours, I'd run a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to hit the track, man. I'm trying to, you know, pick up where I left off.
Mm-hmm. And you're in your 20s.
I'm on 24, 25 uh-huh. by the time, man. I didn't have it, man. And I was never again the same. Anyway, I say that to say Chuck did 6.5 years straight in the hole. And this was a result of protecting other move people that were there.
Mm-hmm.
They got into something, some kind of skirmish, and they had beat some of the other move members that was there, including Carlos and Delbert.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck asked one of the officials about what had happened to his brothers. And he waved him off, and Chuck
knocked him out.
Knocked him out. So they put him in a hole, and he was in a hole for 6.5 years. My point in saying that is that after the 6.5 years, I don't know if Chuck worked out every day
mm-hmm.
or, you know, what kind of regimen he had. But he was boxing before he went in the hole. He was boxing, you know, he just stayed in shape. At the after that 6.5 years, I told you what happened to me in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
In 6.5 years, Chuck came out and became the state champion boxer. He didn't lose a fight.
Hmm.
And they had talent up there, of course, one of which was Bernard Hopkins.
Who Chuck said he was looking forward to fighting.
And that was 20, and he was champ for 20 years, world champ for 20 years. Now, Chuck never fought him, but I'm just saying.
He was slated to fight him. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying that the type of talent that was up there
right.
was phenomenal, man. He fought this brother named Stacy, and I'm telling you, Stacy could have been somewhere, somebody's champ. Stacy was a superb fighter, and that's who Chuck fought and won the championship from.
Mm.
So this is after 6.5 years of being in the hole, eating prison food. He couldn't get his own stuff. You know, sometimes in population, you can sometimes get more raw food if you want it, better food if you want it. You know, you can buy it, you mm-hmm. know. 6.5 years, Chuck had access to none of this stuff. But when he came out and got the chance, you know, he didn't lose a fight.
How many fights did he have, do you know?
Before he became champ was 13. You know, he had a couple before, but I'm saying after the 6.5 years. You know, what I'm saying, Mike, is that it is tremendously hard to be in that situation. You know, we talk about the time we've done in prison, and it is tremendously oppressive, physically and mentally, you know, and worse for people like us who were seen a certain way as revolutionaries, as, you know, just bad actors or whatever. Because they keep people in a hole, and they keep people in a hole for decades, man. When I say Chuck was in a hole for 6.5 years, you know, you got movie that was in for 27. Other people that was there that just, you know, got out, that Alpha Wolfolk and all those guys, that 40,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it is a terribly, terribly oppressive situation. Russell Schultz is another, you know, anyway. So that Chuck came out and still performed on that kind of level is a testament to his heart. Never gave up, man. He didn't care, you know. And I can tell you that after the 6.5 years, Chuck was a tremendous fighter. But they didn't know Chuck before he went to that hole.
Mm.
But anyway, you know, we went to get him that day. When he was released from prison, remember?
Yeah, I do.
We all went mm-hmm. to get him.
I do. I remember.
You know, and we have those shots of his first day out. And, you know, even though he had stage 4 cancer, you know, he had his first meal. But when he got home, he was still trying to work out.
Mm-hmm.
He still was working out.
Yeah.
You know, he's still playing his music and all, but taking walks. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's doing some physical therapy, you know, even though that stuff was painful for him. And it got progressively worse. You know, until the day that they took Chuck out there, out of that house, he had a raised fist saying, don't worry about me. Don't worry about me, man.
Every day he would just ask me when we go down there, he said, how's everybody doing? I said, Chuck, everybody's okay. We, you know, don't even worry about nobody. You just concentrate on yourself and get yourself well. You know, we're here to take care of you. Don't worry about it. Every day. Don't worry about me. And every day, how's everybody doing? How's Diane? How's Whit? How's everybody? How's Sharon? you know, because he was just so concerned about, man, the one knockdown drag-out fight we had about them cat, about his cat, because he had two cats. Mm-hmm. We called his therapy cats.
Alex. That's what he called them?
I called him his therapy cats, but he said because they really helped him a lot, like just being there for him, sit on his chest, they come up to him, and Alice and Gracie, just Chuck was on the floor, crawling on the floor so they wouldn't get out, the house when somebody would come to them. I said, like, what are you doing on the floor, Chuck? I just gotta make sure that they don't get out so they don't get hit by a car. I said, will you quit worrying about them cats? They're gonna be all right. If she gets out, she'll come back. But you can't be falling. You have to make sure you take care of yourself. I know, Debbie, but you don't understand how I feel about them cats. I said, I let it go. I said, okay. Mike said, Deb, just quit arguing about the cats. He said, just do whatever you can. I said, okay. I'm gonna leave him alone. But he was still like, he was still
trying to protect somebody.
Trying to protect any part of life he could think of. And just, you know, even with his own disease, he said, you know what? He said, I guess, even though I'm going through this stuff, he says, still, there's other parts of life that are suffering worse than me. And I got to remember that because, you know, there's people that kids that didn't never do nothing. You know, the kids that he used to support at Shriners Hospital and that other hospital, St. Jude's. And he would send donations to and all and support those kids before he even got cancer. This was while he was in prison. Yep. And he would always say, I think about them kids that are suffering, only 3 or 4 years old, 7 or 8. He said, not just, you know, I think about that to just make myself just keep pushing and keep pushing, you know. And I mean, to have that kind of bravery, like, I it was unimaginable to me.
When we went to pick him up from the prison, he was saying to me, he said, Mike, I got a list of things I want to do. He had all these different things he wanted to do. Man, he wanted to see, you know, different people. And he had this book that he was working on called From Darkness to Gray. And he said, but before I do any of that, Mike, I want to go down to Shriners Hospital. Mm-hmm. I want to visit St. Jude's. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of burn victims. And he wanted to make sure that he sent them some money. And there was a couple of institutions for abused women. And he wanted to make sure that he visited those places and give them whatever hope that he could inspire into them. And the first time I took him somewhere, we went down to Shriners Hospital. Mm-hmm. And he pissed me off a little bit because while we were down there, he said, Mike, give them all your money you got in your pocket. And I was like, wait, Chuck, hold on, man. Listen. I said, wait. Now, okay. I don't spend a lot of money on clothes. I'm not, you know, I drive around in a 20-something year old truck. But when it comes to eating, I eat good food. So I got my week's worth of lunch money in my pocket, which meant it was a couple hundred bucks, right? Chuck said, give it all to him. I'm like, Chuck, listen, man, he said, hold on. He had a couple hundred dollars in his pocket too from people giving him donations and whatever. He gave it all to him. And he's like, give him your money. Mike, come on, Mike, you can get some more. Stop being stingy, Mike. And I was like, Chuck, can I keep today's lunch money? He said, man, give him the money, Mike. Come on, man. You can't be like that, Mike. And I was like, oh, man. I gave him the money. And I just remember like, thinking to myself, they're going to eat good today. The people we gave the money to, they're
going to eat good right, today. Right, that the kids wasn't going to get it, right?
Yeah, because to me, there wasn't a check. It wasn't a big enough thing, a check that you're giving someone, an institution where they could, you know, recognize it, right? Chuck wasn't thinking about that. He wasn't concerned. All he cared about was making sure that this example was set, you know, and it was just a really good example for me to see. I already knew he was unselfish, but to actually see him come home and like make good on his promises. And then he was telling him like, listen, this ain't going to be the last time you see me. And then a little while later, hey, Mike, I want to go down to Shriners. What you doing today? And we went back down there and did the same thing. I didn't take as much money that day, but we did the same thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. And that's just Chuck. And then, like, the other thing that he did that was really amazing to me was Chuck didn't have any, he didn't have any money. And we did a GoFundMe for him and some money came in from that. And he used a lot of that to do his own, whatever house, for the house or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But with the money he had, he was sending it back to his friends that were still in jail.
Yep.
Hundreds, $200 at a time. Mm-hmm. Send, make sure you send this to JoJo. Make sure, did they respond and let you know they got their money, Mike? I didn't get no letter saying they got it. Make sure they got that money, Mike, JoJo, mm-hmm. and the Thin Man and all mm-hmm. of these different people mm-hmm. that he made sure. And it wasn't $20. It was $100, $200 to $300 at a time. You know, to make sure that, like, you know, the people that's still on the inside, you know, felt his love.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was very, very impactful to me, mm-hmm. especially since, you know, I seen a lot of move people come home from prison, a lot. And I never saw that with the other people. You know what I mean? Sending money back. I mean, people, they talked about other people a lot, but to have that kind of, like, you know, it almost felt like he was doing something wrong, because mm-hmm. we were taught that everything Move does is right. So when you see Chuck doing something different, it almost is like, why are you doing that mm-hmm. a little bit, you know? Mm-hmm. But that was Chuck. He mm-hmm. he yep. cared about, he had a heart. He cared about people.
Yes, he did. Yep.
We really love the back and forth, you know, about sports or music. You know, we played in bands together. You know, Chuck picked up things, man. He played the piano and the guitar and the flute and the trombone. And we was in jazz ensembles up there and won stuff, you know. But debating about different music and stuff, man, Chuck was not just a walking encyclopedia, as they used to call him, about information, but he was also that way about artists, mm-hmm. and you know, he knew a lot of stuff, man. He knew a lot of history, you know, and it was fun.
You know what's interesting about Chuck to me, and I don't know if I've seen this in other people, his ability to accept certain things, right? How do I mean this? In the hills of Pennsylvania, the type of music that comes through the radio out there is different than the type of music that you choose when you're at a record store, right? When Chuck came home and playing this damn Eddie Rabbit person, I Love a Rainy Night. Well, you could be okay, Chuck, you're home now. You could pick any music you want, the stuff that you haven't heard since the 60s. You can just type it into the thing, whatever, YouTube or whoever, and you can listen to anything. He said, Mike, put on Eddie Rabbit, I Love a Rainy Night.
Yeah, you don't like that song? That was a cool song.
Now, I had a nice little tune to it, right? But the thing about it was, I didn't expect it. Yeah. I expected some Marvin Gaye or some Temptations, Earth, Wind, and Fire, or something like that. He said, put on Eddie Rabbit.
Yeah, you can debate almost about every genre of music. And maybe pop more than most. So you can debate a debate with him about music and not include the 10,000 Maniacs or, you know, some other pop artists. Chuck is very knowledgeable about that whole genre of music. Right. Very.
Yeah.
You know, so. Yeah. But, and jazz. And jazz, too. Especially straight ahead. What they call real jazz. You know, uh-huh. He's really, very knowledgeable, man. So, then boxers. Or basketball, as we were talking about earlier, you know.
Yeah.
He knows all that stuff.
He's so passionate.
It's fun.
Yeah, passionate. That's a really good word to describe him. Because he gets into it and, man, you'd be like, Chuck, calm down. It's not that deep. Yes, it is, Mike. LeBron James is not. Listen, let me tell you something. LeBron James, man, these guys are soft. Hey, Mike. These guys today, man, these guys is made up. Where they find these guys at, man? These guys can't play.
I hope this is not on.
Yeah, that's just go into it, man.
He sure did.
Yeah.
And he's very passionate. I used to watch, I watched Mike and Chuck every day for about a year. Every day, I'm telling you, every day, except maybe Sunday, sometime. And they would, you know, what you want to do today, Chuck? Hey, Mike, let's put on some movies. And he watched movies. I kid you not, he made us watch Crimson Tides 8 times in 1 month. Crimson Tides.
Boys from Brazil.
Boys from Brazil. I probably know that movie backward and forward. And what was the other one he watched?
Something in New York. The Kings of New York.
Every day. He's very repetitive. And then every day we went to Yummy's on Baltimore Avenue, right around the corner from you, to get him grits, eggs, and toast. And sometimes pancakes, maybe once a week. Every day. So they got to know him. I would say, okay, this order is for Chuck. So when I would call in the order, I say, can I have grits, eggs, and toast? She said, okay, is this for Chuck? I said, yep, this is for Chuck. And, you know, I introduced him one day when I we went there when he was still walking around. And so that they would know. And, you know, so they got to kind of, I think, have a little soft heart. Like, okay, like a familiarity without mm-hmm. really knowing him. But every day we got him Yummy's every day. And that was his last meal. He had grits. Gail bought him on that Sunday. He had grits, eggs, and toast. He didn't eat much, though. But that was his last meal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a lot of the things that he wanted to do, he got to do. A lot of things he wanted to do, he didn't get to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the hardest part for me. You know, some of the things he asked me to do. You know, I put my effort into to make it happen and I did what I could, but I know he wanted to do certain things, but being able to call him
mm-hmm.
and just drop by to hear his complaint about something, you know, I'm really gonna miss him.
Yeah. And he really loved it. When you called in, he loved it. He was just like, Mike, oh man. You know, but yeah, he really yeah. loved it. He loved his
and
family.
He had a lot of dedicated supporters. I don't know. I don't want to say too many people's names, but they know.
Right.
He had
a core.
That just, they were there for him
yes.
every step of the way. Throughout from start to finish, never mm-hmm. wavered.
Nope.
Even when other people deserted them, they were like, nah.
Mm-hmm.
And there was never a question, never a consideration. These people just, it wasn't, I mean, it was just, they were rocks.
Yep. To the end. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And I really appreciated them
mm-hmm.
for the way they were with him.
And so did he.
And so did he.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. His heart. That's one thing about Chuck though. He ain't, when it comes to when he feel like it's right or prejudice or like he's not, like he don't care. He don't care if there's a room full of 25, 40 people and he's the only one saying it. If he feel like he's right, like he ain't gonna waver. He'll fight to the death. Because he feels like he know he's right and I don't care who don't agree with me and I don't care if you're my sister, my brother. I'm not going to go along with what's something that's wrong.
Mm.
And that was his principle. He didn't care. Niece and nephew, nothing. Well, you're wrong. You're not, you know, and he'll fight. But he loved just as hard.
Mm-hmm.
He loved just as hard.
We could do this all day.
Oh, yeah.
But I think we made the point.
But I'm glad he's out of pain. And that was my, like, I'm going to miss him and stuff, but I'll tell you what, I'm just glad he's out of pain. He's out of pain.
Yeah. Love you, Chuck.
Love you, Chuck. Always.
Love you, brother.
Always love Chuck. Yep. Name is going down in history.
I'm glad he always knew it. I'm glad he always felt it.
Yep.
And we felt it from him.
And I'll tell you, Mike, you being around for him like that those last year and a half, that meant so much. Because even though I'm his sister, it's a difference. You did all that time with him and graded for it. You know, I wasn't there, so he's not that familiar. But that, I think that really, 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 really made his the rest of his life so much more meaningful and gave him so much more quality. The times you would just sit with him for 7 hours at a time sometimes, like 6-7 hours a day, like 6 days a week, you know, like for a whole a year. Like, and it was hard work, but, you know, I know he really appreciated it. And nobody, when Chucky appreciates something, you can take it to the bank. Like he, and he would give you his limb, his arm, his, you know, if he felt like, you know, you're somebody that he loves, you know, yep. But, yeah. But I appreciate it too, because it helped me a lot. Because Mike, you know how your dad is. He's so wise. Like he don't say a lot, but when he does, yeah. So he helped me.
Yeah.
In many situations with Chuck.
All right. That is a wrap for this day. Thanks, Mom and Dad, for coming and talking about this one. I know that this is a bittersweet one, but it's really, really encouraging to hear these really good things about Chuck. And for all the people out there that supported Chuck throughout his throughout your time with him, I really want to extend a great deal of gratitude to you and to all of the people that he touched and that he loved. I appreciate you for being in his life. Until next time, peace out.